Before we start, a quick heads up. Today's episode deals with the topic of mental health and describes an attempted suicide. Thank you for listening.
There were so many days that I can just remember, like, I just didn't understand what was going on. I felt embarrassed. I felt like I was letting my family down. That headspace that you're in, it's really hard to explain that to people who don't go through mental health issues, because there's some pretty dark thoughts that are that trap you. And one night, you know, I was drinking and doing some things and made a lot of bad decisions and ended up, you know, trying to take my own life and ended up in a hospital room and was just handcuffed to a bed, wearing the jeans from the night before with no shirt on, just sitting there kind of reflecting on my choices. For me, that was pretty much rock bottom, and that's the moment that I reflect on when times get tough nowadays.
That was Atlanta Falcons tight end Hayden Hurst talking about the most difficult night of his life. A former first-round draft pick, Hurst excelled in sports growing up, but he also battled personal demons off the field. Today, as part of Mental Health Awareness Month, he tells us how his experiences with depression and anxiety led him to nearly take his own life, and explains why he decided to open up. I'm Mina Kimes. It's Wednesday, May 20th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by Marathon. Hi, Hayden.
Hey, Mina, how you doing?
I'm good. So, Hayden, you're getting ready for your third season in the NFL. You were drafted in the first round by the Baltimore Ravens in 2018, but were traded to the Falcons this offseason. What is it like getting to know a new team virtually over Zoom meetings during this crazy time?
Kind of right now, everything that's going on, you know, with the Falcons, we have our team meetings at 11 a.m. every morning. We do that Monday through Thursdays. And then right after those meetings, I have a trainer here in Jacksonville, Florida. And I actually have like a little makeshift gym in my garage in my house. So he comes over and I get my workout in, and then I'll go over plays and stuff after that. And then for the past 4 weeks, actually, me and Matt have been throwing up in Atlanta. So I've been driving back and forth and working with him. And that's helping me a lot. And it's really going to pay off during training camp.
You're in Jacksonville right now. That's where you grew up, right?
Right. Correct. Born and raised.
What was that like?
I love Florida. Just being in Jacksonville, it's a pretty tight community where I'm from. Pretty great sports community as well. There's really good baseball and football programs in North Florida. So I've always just kind of been immersed in sports from as far as I can remember. It was always baseball and football. It was just whatever season it was, you know, I was 100% in on that sport. And then when the other season rolled around, I just jumped in 100%.
But you were more serious about baseball, right, when you were growing up?
Correct. Just, I don't know what it was. I guess just because I was so talented, you know, I threw the ball really hard and everyone was always like, oh man, Hayden, you're going to be pitching in the MLB for years to come. And I don't know what it was with football. It was always just, it came easy to me. You know, I never really thought of it as a business or like a monetary thing, I guess, like I did baseball. So I was able just to go out there and kind of flip the switch and just be the athlete that God intended me to be.
I read that you threw 90 in eighth grade. Is that true?
Yeah, I was throwing 91 and I actually ended up having Tommy John. Yeah.
In high school?
Yeah, when I was 14. I was growing so fast. There was like 2 summers in a row. I grew like 4 inches and 5 inches. So my bones were stretching out that ligament and my body was just doing things that my ligaments weren't capable of keeping up with. And I ended up having Tommy John. But I actually came back throwing harder. So it's kind of strange how that works out.
So in high school as a pitcher, did it seem feasible to you that you could play not only in college, but perhaps in the majors?
I think for me, I started connecting those dots when I was a freshman, going like 94 miles an hour as a freshman in high school. Had college scouts coming and looking at me, and you know, most of my games were kind of filled out with MLB scouts in the back. So I was probably, you know, 15, 16 years old and started, you know, realizing that was probably going to become a reality for me.
So you're drafted by the Pirates in 2012. What happened next?
I went straight down to Bradenton, Florida, to their rookie team, and ended up being there for about 2.5, 3 years. First year was pretty decent. And then I started developing the yips, and it kind of, my professional baseball career kind of unraveled from there.
For those who don't know, can you explain what the yips are?
Yeah, so the yips, I know they're pretty frequent in golf, and I think that's kind of where people understand them a little bit more. But in baseball, it's like for me, I would stand on the foul line or I'd be on the mound, and I would just feel total loss of control. The ball would just feel foreign in my hand, and my hands would start sweating, my hands would start shaking, and you know, I'd have panic attacks, and I would have zero confidence. I would not want to be out there. I'd want to go in. I wouldn't want to throw the ball because I'd have no idea where it was going. I just didn't understand what was going on. I felt embarrassed. I felt like I was letting my family down because, you know, everyone expected me to be, you know, 2 years in the minor league system, 3 years maybe, and then be pitching in the big leagues. And it's just not how it all worked out. And it really started affecting me off the field. Had some problems with anxiety and depression issues. There's just so many days where I'd be sitting in my dorm room down there in Bradenton, Florida, and just I wouldn't want to be around people. I'd sit in a dark room and just watch TV just because I was so embarrassed. Being an 18-year-old kid and having to explain that to your family is pretty tough. It took me about 2 years to actually open up to them and tell them what was going on.
When did you make the decision to walk away from baseball?
So I want to say it was probably March of 2015. I got down there for spring training and it was just pretty bad, to be honest. You know, I was hitting the fence behind the catcher and I was spiking balls and I kind of just broke down in tears. And I went in the locker room and sat down with him and I was like, man, I hate this. Like, I have no idea what's going on anymore. I'm not passionate about this. I feel burned out. The pitching coach down there, his name is Scott Ellerton. He just asked me point blank. He goes, what are you passionate about? And my answer was football. And it was just, I don't know what it was, but it was always in the back of my mind every day down there in Bradenton that some way, somehow that I knew I could make football work.
So how did you go about getting back into football?
So one of my good buddies, he's actually from Jacksonville. His name is Perry Orth. At the time, he was the backup quarterback at South Carolina. And I remember sometime in the spring of 2015, I reached out to him. And I just reached out and I said, hey, Perry, tell me about college football. You know, what are the workouts like? What are the seasons like? What's college like? You know, I've never experienced that. I went straight to professional baseball, so I didn't get to experience college at first. So I just kind of picked his brain a little bit. And he said, hey, man, if you're going to do this thing, we need tight ends. We're a little thin at the position. I think it would be a perfect fit for you. And he's really the reason why I made the decision, to be totally honest.
So Hayden, you leave baseball and in the fall of 2015, you walk onto the football team at the University of South Carolina as a 22-year-old freshman. I imagine you've left some of those mental struggles and challenges behind, but did it really go away once you started playing football or did you feel like you were bottling them up?
For me, the thing that carried over was the off-the-field stuff. Just the drinking and that decision making wasn't my my proudest moment my freshman year, but you know, it took me, you know, making that decision that night to drink and to take pills and to get to where I'm at now. I think that's a huge part of the person that I am today, but unfortunately I had to go through some things to get to where I'm at today.
What happened that night in January 2016?
I was out with some buddies and we were drinking and I decided to take pills with drinking. And for me, when I was drinking, if I didn't reach the point where I would incapacitate myself, I would have some pretty dark and depressed thoughts. So that was kind of always the goal when I was drinking, is just to kind of numb the pain. I felt like I let my family down, leaving baseball and things like that. So there was a lot of pressure on me. So when I would drink and go out with my friends, it wasn't necessarily a social or casual thing. It was me trying to escape those feelings of embarrassment and disappointment. If I didn't reach the point where I would incapacitate myself, it was pretty scary, the thoughts that would go through my mind. And unfortunately, that night, I guess, was just a culmination of everything from those 3 years. I ended up going back to my apartment and I cut my wrist and ended up in the hospital.
What was it like when you came to in the hospital?
Oh, I was just, and I want to say shocked, but just disappointed in myself. Just because, you know, my parents were in Jacksonville, Florida. They had to drive up 4 hours. You know, I'm sure they were absolutely terrified. My sister as well. She actually drove to Columbia from Atlanta. But I don't know if I have a word to describe the way I was feeling. But at that moment where I was sitting there handcuffed to a hospital bed, I was just so disappointed in myself that I let everything get to that point.
Hayden, at the time when this was all happening and when you were lying in that bed, did you feel like you had an understanding of why you did it?
I do. You know, I know outside looking in, it's hard to understand when people make those decisions and they have those suicidal thoughts. You know, a lot of people just say, well, you know, you're really affecting the people that you leave behind. But when you're in that headspace, in that frame of mind, the only thing that you really think about is making the pain go away. And for me, that pain was that embarrassment of letting my family down, that embarrassment of, you know, feeling like I had baseball ripped away from me for no reason. And those times are really hard when you're by yourself. And, you know, obviously alcohol didn't help my cause at all. But that headspace that you're in, it's really hard to explain that to people who don't go through mental health issues, because there's some pretty dark thoughts that are that trap you, and you feel like the only way to end that pain is to end your life.
All right, after the break, let's talk about how you finally sought help and why you decided to open up about this.
Hi guys, given everything that is happening in the world right now, most of us are buying things online. I saw that AT&T started doing two really helpful things for those who want to buy a new phone or device online. They are offering fast, free, non-contact delivery and curbside pickup so that online shopping is as simple and safe as possible. On top of that, they have a flexible return policy so you can shop at ease. You can visit att.com to learn how to shop online from the safety of your home 24/7. Subject to change, restrictions apply.
So Hayden, after you came to in the hospital bed and realized what you had attempted to do, what happened next?
So they set me up with a therapist at the school. His name is Dr. Timothy Malone. And I met with him probably three times a week for about 2 months. And he was awesome just because he didn't judge me at all for what had gone on. He was just there to talk. Again, I'm not big on my emotions and expressing how I feel through my words, I guess. But he was really good in getting me to come out of my shell. It was really, really good for me to talk to him and just tell him what was going on and all the thoughts that were crossing my mind.
Hayden, I asked you what your understanding of the situation was back when it happened. What about over, you know, the following months and years as you started working through this, what did you learn about yourself and perhaps what led to that moment?
For me, everything that, you know, had happened, I can always go back and point to alcohol. I'm a totally different person, you know, in a headspace when I drink. There's a chemical imbalance in my brain, and then adding alcohol to that just exacerbates the issue, you know, tenfold. And for me, cutting that out, you know, 4.5 years without a drink, not even a sip of alcohol, and going on 5, and I'm in a totally different headspace without it. And I think that really affected me. I think with the Hirst family, we have an addictive personality. So being able to kind of put a finger on alcohol and drug use and things like that, and being like, hey, that's something that you need to cut out of your life, or it, you know, it's going to extremely affect you down the road.
You had an uncle and a cousin who died by suicide.
Right.
Was that something that weighed on you throughout all this?
It did when I was younger. Again, you know, I'm not the most emotional person. For me, I internalize a lot of things. And my uncle was like almost like a second father to me. They lived across the street, and, you know, I would hang out with him all the time. go over there, you know, watch hockey and just kind of hang out with him and my cousin. And he was like my brother. I always looked up to him. We did everything together for about 4 years. When I was probably 10 to 14 years old. And, you know, having them take their lives back then really affected me, just because they were always kind of there and we were always hanging out, and to have them, I guess, you know, just make that decision and be gone. And it's sad because they miss out on so much great things in our family. You know, with me playing in the NFL, you know, his daughter had a daughter, so he's missing out being a grandpa. It's just, it's tough, you know, to sit back and to think they should be here still.
You mentioned drinking being a trigger. What other mm-hmm. steps have you taken in your own life to keep this under control over the last few years?
For me, one of the most important things that I kind of discovered was journaling. Again, not to say it again, but I'm not the most emotional person, but journaling gave me an outlet. Any thought that came across my mind throughout the entire day, I was able to put it on paper, get those toxic thoughts out of my head, instead of internalizing them and just, you know, harping on all those thoughts throughout the day.
So you resumed your college career and thrived to the point where, you know, you were seen as a top prospect headed into the NFL draft.
Bentley over the middle. He's got Hurst. Touchdown, South Carolina.
Somehow Hayden Hurst hauls it in.
Hurst bullies his way in for six. The big run.
Were you worried at all going into that process that there would be a stigma attached to you because of this?
You know, a little bit. It was something that me and my agent had talked about, you know, whether I wanted to come out with the full story yet or not. But really, I think the Ravens knew a lot of my story. I think they were pretty intrigued with it, and they understood the man that I had become. You know, obviously that's a part of my story, unfortunately, you know, just because of those decisions that I made when I was younger, but I felt like they were comfortable with who I was.
With the 25th pick, the Baltimore Ravens select Hayden Hurst, tight end, South Carolina.
What made you decide to start opening up about your story?
For me, I genuinely want to help people, and I know mental health is not talked about enough. And I know people who have mental health issues are afraid to talk about it just because of the reaction that they get from most people. I think the platform that I have been given is incredible. And for me not to use it in a positive way, I couldn't see myself doing that. And I think I have a pretty good story to tell that could help people kind of avoid the decisions that I made. And then also to see the silver lining in it, being like, man, he was at rock bottom and he was able to dig himself out of that hole and turn his life into what it is now. Again, you know, I just want to put that story out there for people to see, and hopefully they can avoid the mistakes that I made.
Is that why you created the Hayden Hurst Family Foundation?
Absolutely. Our foundation focuses on mental health and suicide prevention in adolescents. It's an age group that we want to target and help just because in life, you know, things happen, you know, traumas happen, losses happen. It's unfortunate, but if we can give kids the tools, you know, to be better suited to deal with that when they get older, you know, that's the goal.
Have you heard from people with similar experiences?
I have. The feedback that I've gotten, you know, through our social media accounts, our foundation account, my personal account, of people saying, hey, I had no idea you went through this. I think people see us on the field, you know, they see these superheroes, and they think, oh, these guys aren't normal people. They don't go through all these things that we go through. And they're seeing my story out there, and they're going, oh man, I can relate to this. I can relate to this. And they're telling me, you know, my family has gone through this, I've gone through this, and to hear your story has helped me a ton. When I hear stuff like that and read things like that, it's just extremely humbling.
Do you think because athletes are seen as superheroes and, you know, face so much pressure on the field, they face unique mental health challenges?
I think so. It's just, there's so many things, you know, that are expected of you as an athlete. And there's a lot of pressures that come with it to perform. And then, you know, you're counted on to support your family, and, you know, you're supposed to be the source of income for everybody. It's tough if you don't manage it the right way, or if you don't have the right group around you. You know, it could be extremely, extremely hard to deal with. But luckily for me, you know, I have a pretty solid foundation and support system here at home that, you know, whenever I'm feeling, you know, overwhelmed or anything like that, you know, we can talk our way through things. And my family has been, you know, my soundboard, my rock for these last, you know, 6-7 years of going through all this. And they continue to be there for me today.
Hayden, you mentioned how close you are with your family, but you also said, you know, back when you were struggling, you had a hard time confiding in them. Why do you think that was?
Just because they had always seen me, you know, how easy sports came. And, you know, I never had any issues at all with any of these things going on. And for me, I guess it was tough at first to kind of break down and tell them, hey, this is going on, just because in their eyes, you know, I was always so strong. It's just crazy how it all works, because you sit there and you're thinking to yourself, oh, I don't want to open up and tell them what's going on because they're going to be disappointed. They're going to be embarrassed. And it's actually the exact opposite. You know, you open up and you tell them, hey, you know, this is going on. I'm really embarrassed. And then the feedback you get from your family and your loved ones is just incredible, because those people want to see you succeed so badly, and they care for you and they love you so much that they're going to be there, you know, wherever you need them, however you need them to talk to show up. You know, your family is pretty incredible and pretty resilient.
Thanks so much, Hayden.
Thanks for having me, Mina. I really appreciate it.
For more on Hayden's story, you can watch him on the noon Eastern Sports Center tomorrow. Coming up, why the NFL changed the Rooney Rule, but still has a long way to go. We're presented by Marathon. Now, more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. And Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for high-quality, top-tier gas. While we are aware travel might not be top of mind, there might be times where you have to hop in the car to run an errand. Maybe you have to drop off groceries and supplies to your family. Maybe you've become an amazing baker and want to drop off a few dozen cookies on your best friend's porch. Or maybe you just want to drive around to all of your friends' homes simply to wave from a safe distance. But before you head out, remember to fuel up at Marathon. Marathon gasolines are formulated with STP additives. They keep your vehicle running at peak performance by optimizing fuel economy, removing those ugly deposit buildups, and reducing emissions. Remember, wherever you need to go, the people at Marathon are behind you all the way. Marathon, fueling the American spirit.
Here's another story I want you to know. This week, the NFL announced they're changing the Rooney Rule, the program that requires teams to interview non-white candidates for coaching jobs. Under the new guidelines, teams must interview at least 2 minority candidates from outside the organization for head coaching jobs and 1 candidate for coordinator positions, which had no requirements before. They must also interview non-white candidates from outside the team for senior football ops or GM jobs. The rule change also mandates that clubs can no longer deny assistant coaches and executives the chance to interview for coordinator and assistant GM positions. The changes were prompted by an offseason in which, of the 5 head coaches hired, just 1, Ron Rivera, was not white. This is a trend that's been in place for years. Just 3 of the last 20 coaching hires were minorities, and right now, there are only 4 non-white head coaches in the NFL. The new rule wasn't the most dramatic proposal considered this offseason. A few days ago, news leaked that the NFL was considering a proposal to incentivize the hiring of minority coaches and executives by awarding draft picks, enabling teams to improve their standing in the 3rd round. According to the NFL Network's Jim Trotter, this idea was tabled at a virtual meeting on Tuesday. The suggestion was met with a great deal of backlash when it was floated, with critics arguing that such benefits would be demeaning for qualified candidates. But I'd argue the plan wasn't demeaning to candidates, but rather to the league itself. Because in suggesting that teams and owners had to be essentially bribed to improve diversity, the NFL shed a light on where things currently stand and how little progress has been made.
I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.